with Sophie Black.
Hello and welcome back. My guest this week is a writer and actress and comedian, Barunka O'Shaughnessy. Looking at Wikipedia, it says she's best known for playing Sasha Marion on Beau in the USA. I don't agree with that, because I've never heard of Beau in the USA. So, whatever. So if you have and you've watched it, then brilliant. If not, she's also been in The Mighty Boosh, Beehive, which is what I remember her in. In fact, I mentioned it last week and said it probably had Lucy Montgomery in it. Well, it didn't. So that's a great compliment to Lucy Montgomery in the sense that I obviously imagine she's been in everything. But it did actually have the amazing Sarah Kendall. So I actually feel really ashamed of that. And in fact, we mentioned Sarah in this episode, and I might try and get her on because she would be a brilliant person to talk to. She's been in a lot of comedy over the years and co-wrote Hunderby with Julia Davis. And yeah, she's brilliant. And we had a great chat, so much so that we overran and I was 20 minutes late for a meeting. So well done, Barunka. Anyway, we began by trying to remember the last time we'd seen each other, which I believe was seeing Jane Eyre at the National.
At the theatre?
At the theatre.
Yes, the theatre.
And you had just had your daughter and I was about to have my son.
Yeah.
And you'd gone to have a little cry in the interval.
I remember I saw you and I was quite emotional. I mean, it was a moving play.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. But I was also just a heap of hormones, and I saw you and went, hello, it's so nice to see you. And then I had to pop to the loo for a cry. And then afterwards I had to run off home weeping, sitting on the bus, weeping all the way home. It was just so moving and overwhelming. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I saw it now, I'd
be
dead,
like, nah.
Whatever. I'm a fucking orphan. Who gives a shit? But no, I have to say, it was quite interesting. First time in my life to actually sort of tap into emotions.
Did you?
And feel them wholly and hysterically.
Was that a frightening experience or quite a good experience?
It was good, I think. I mean, in retrospect, it was good. I think at the time I was clearly going slightly insane.
Yeah.
I think I was. Like a full 2 years it took me to recover.
Really?
Yeah. I think about it. I go, what was the sort of the tipping point? Partly when I started taking medication. But also, there was definitely a point when I went, right, okay, I sort of feel relatively normal now.
Do you think a friend of mine said that she felt normal after she stopped breastfeeding? Was that a thing?
Or? Oh, well, I couldn't.
Oh, right, so it wasn't even
so that.
So that
made me, obviously, right. You know, I know you've discussed that.
Yeah.
But that made me, that contributed to the whole madness. It was, yeah, it was, you know, I mean, I'm normally quite anxious and can be relatively irrational and have ups and downs, but this was just a whole other kind of scale of just, yeah, proper insanity, I think. I mean, not like psychotic, not like kind of postnatal psychosis, which is, you know, terrifying.
Yeah.
But there was definitely, like, there was something going on.
Definitely.
A lot of something going on.
Were you able to talk yourself down? Were you able to kind of go intellectually, I know that this is hormonal, or were you kind of like going, no, this is because this isn't happening?
Well, you don't, for whatever reason, and it's like a sort of, I don't know if it's a kind of biological self-destruct, that you don't ever allow yourself to think that it might be your biology that's causing this. So it's always your fault entirely, and you're entirely in control of your madness.
Yeah.
And then my sort of way of dealing with it was by constantly Googling, obviously, anything that was...
God,
why do I hate my child? Is it normal to hate your child? I mean, terrible!
So was it along those lines? Was it sort of almost postnatal depression? Or?
I think it must have been.
Right, yeah.
I mean, it didn't sort of ever manifest in one particular incident. It was just a constant sort of... You know, obviously, I mean, there must have been good times. It's so weird looking at photos where I'm sort of smiling.
Yeah.
So I'm smiling for the camera and holding my baby. And I think, oh, fucking hell, I didn't enjoy any of that. It's terrible. And she was so cute. And I look back now and I used to think she was horrific. Like that she looked like a fat Polish builder and had a square head and sticking out ears. I even taped her ears back. And now I look back and I go, what a cute little baby. My baby was cute.
God, and that must have felt
quite lonely. Because presumably everyone comes around and goes, oh, isn't this wonderful? Isn't she lovely? And you're just thinking, no one understands how I'm feeling.
I don't know. Well, luckily, you know, we have similar sort of friends that are, you can be pretty things. Brutally honest about things like that. Sort of go, I think I hate my baby. And they'll go, yeah, it's all right, whatever. yeah, that happens. I mean, I don't. I love my baby, but that's a thing. So that was like one level of friends. But then there were some, I was very lucky. I had a group of NCT friends of similar age, all with just one kid, obviously, because it's always your first kid you go to those groups with. And they were really lovely. They were all able to breastfeed, and they all seemed to be having a really kind of easy, good time of it. And I would go, she's horrific. She's got acne. Why has my baby got acne? None of yours have got acne.
Yeah.
And they just sort of go, because we didn't know each other well enough for them to go, shut up. Yeah. Except once when I did send a message, this was when I was still on WhatsApp before that sent me mad.
Yeah.
And I went, I think she's got Down syndrome. And one of them happened to be a paediatrician. And she went, no, don't worry, she really doesn't. But but it turns out, again, in retrospect, because I'm still in touch with a couple of them, they were going equally mad. But they just hadn't found the right pitch to be able to say that to each other. Whereas luckily I had other friends who I could express that to.
Yeah. Someone said something to me recently about grief and saying that the symptom of grief, like a symptom of grief is loneliness. And everyone says they feel lonely, but they think they're the only one who feels lonely. And it's like, actually, that's if you see that as just a symptom of grief, and that's what it is. And I wonder if having a baby is a bit like that too. Like, I remember feeling like that on a WhatsApp group and thinking, oh, I'm having experience A, and you're all having experience Z, and there's kind of I can't even explain how different our experiences are, but they are completely worlds apart.
Yeah.
And actually, they probably weren't. The little things that were working for me weren't working for them.
Well, it's totally isolating because you've never done it before.
Yeah,
you go,
exactly,
this is just horrific. And also we are, microscopically unique in that our experiences are unique.
Yeah,
and so actually on some level you can't ever really fully connect your specific experience.
Yeah.
But I also remember that, I don't know what David was like, but my partner, Tom, he'd already had a child, but not that he was a full-time dad with him, but he sort of had this innate kind of warmth and love, which he shed a tear when my daughter was born, and I was just lying there going, oh God. And he was like, he seemed to be doing it, and so that sort of almost let me off the hook, because I thought,
she's getting
love
what she needs
from at least one of us. And I don't think I was unloving.
No.
I mean, I probably I'm sure I was fine.
Yeah.
Somebody would have pointed it out if I was really awful.
Yeah.
But he was just, he sort of, that helped actually, because I was like, oh God, she's got him.
Yeah.
At least she's got him, even if I kind of get carted off or run away. That was the main thing. I was like, how can I get away?
Yeah.
How can I get away?
Yeah.
First time I ever got away was, weirdly, I had to stay with my friend's parents because Tom went on tour. When Maud was 10 days old, he went to Australia.
Oh, my God.
And that didn't help. But that's not his fault. It was a job.
And
I was staying with my friend's parents. And they live around the corner from their other daughter. And I've known these people since I was, like, 8. And she said, oh, I've got a ticket for Grand Designs. I went, oh, I'd love to go to the Grand Designs exhibition. She went, well, go. I went, what? And Maud was, like, 2 weeks old.
Yeah.
I went, what do you mean? She went, just go. I know. I've had 3 children. I know what to do. She was really excited to get her hands on a baby.
Yeah.
I was like, what's wrong with you? Why do you want to go after a baby? And I remember walking out and shutting the door and going, I'm free!
Yeah.
So free!
I had
a lovely time wandering around looking at
I still
bathroom.
Have, like, sometimes kind of, I'll say things like, oh, it's so pathetic. I have this sort of ongoing joke with David where I'll go and kids are screaming, I'm dealing and everything's in that, and then I'll go, oh, by the way, sorry, I forgot to tell you, there's a car picking me up tomorrow morning and taking me to Heathrow, and I'm going to go to Venezuela for,
not actually Venezuela wouldn't be very good right now, but
Mauritius for 3 weeks. Okay, all right, night. Like that, and he just doesn't even laugh now. I don't even laugh now. But there's a point
one
where you
day,
think if they're
David,
all upstairs,
one day,
exactly. exactly. They're all upstairs. You think, I could just walk out now and get in my car and drive off.
Escape. I had heard that before, actually, that story. It was from an ex-boyfriend's mum, and she was talking about him as a kid. And, I mean, they had au pairs and stuff, so I don't know what she was moaning about. Anyway, but it was she said she actually left, and she got in the car and drove away.
Right.
And then got, I don't know how far, and then went, oh, God, what am I doing?
Yeah. And maybe you just need to know that you can do that.
Yeah.
And that actually 2 weeks in, you went to Grand Designs and wandered around and was like, actually,
I can do this.
It's more the
psychological prospect of being tied emotionally for the rest of your life to this creature. And I think that's what, you know, when people say they're overwhelmed by love as soon as they see their baby, I was like, I don't think it is that. Well, it wasn't that for me. I think it's a massive sense of terrifying responsibility and the fact that you would do anything to protect this creature. And that's the sort of, that's the feeling. Yeah. I don't know if that's love. Whatever love is, as Prince Charles, my hero, said.
Oh, yes.
Well, in my definition, love is an overwhelming sense of responsibility for another.
And pain.
But that was it. It was like, ah, shit, this is it now. Like, I can't. But whatever happens now, that's it. I'm tied.
But maybe that is love. I mean, that's a big part of love. My dad recently got had a little TIA thing, like a mini stroke, like a pre-stroke thing.
Oh.
But he's had one before. But my mum had several strokes before she died, so it was quite a
trigger. It's quite triggering for me and my brother.
And my brother rang me up in floods of tears. Oh my God, it's happening again. You know, this is and I had this real, like, basically I'm telling a story now where I was really wise and my brother was really
I admire
stupid.
You.
but it was this realization, which is like, the reason you're all you're doing is saying I love my dad. Really, isn't it? Because it's like, you can't control it. There's nothing you can do. He's getting older. It is going to happen at some point, hopefully not for ages, but that is the reason you're crying is because you love him.
Mm.
And if you didn't love him, you wouldn't be crying, and thank God you're crying, kind of thing.
He sounds very in touch with his emotions.
Yes, he is actually very in touch with his feelings. And,
that must make things a bit more straightforward. We're all just a family of ciphers in our lot.
Really?
You never quite know. Sometimes you wonder if there's anything going on beneath the surface.
What?
Well, there is.
Open the front door and I can go out.
If I'd been stuck with a child 24/7, I would have been fucked.
Yeah.
But luckily, because Tom does what we do, he's flexible.
Yeah.
And it was always the deal that we would share everything.
Yeah.
As I'm sure I tell you now, that balance has tipped slightly and he's doing more childcare than I am, for which I'm very grateful, Tom, when I have to express my gratitude when I get in trouble. But yeah, it was reassuring to go, oh, I can still function mentally, as in practically mentally, and not emotionally. I mean, that's another matter.
And did you find, you were talking about the emotion of everything, did that kind of change your writing at all, or did you find that you were sort of writing characters in a different way, or that you were understanding things in a different way?
Yeah, no, I think it must do fundamentally. Not at that stage. When she was a baby, certainly not, because I hadn't quite, obviously, as I said, it took me 2 years to kind of realise what was going on and go, oh, fuck, right, okay.
Yeah.
And then to actually finally go, oh, this is probably life-changing, but in a positive way.
Yeah.
But that understanding of motherhood, I suppose, and that kind of the wonders of motherhood, and in a very sort of cheesy way, you go with the miracle of it all, you know. And again, being an older mother, it is a miracle that you've managed to, like, get knocked up and poo out a baby, and there was, you know, and health and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And things didn't go horrifically wrong, and, you know, it was just you sort of go, I've done this thing, and it was nothing that I'd ever wanted to do before, never dreamt of being a mother, never wanted to be particularly, and then I suddenly panicked and went, oh, what if I regret not ever having been one, so I better try and be one, and sort of managed to corral Tom into providing me with his seed. Very reluctantly he agreed. We produced a child who he quite likes now, so, you know,
it's worked out really well,
thanks Tom. And then But then to go, okay, this is changed, and like, just there's no going back. And if anything ever happened, that would be it. My life would be over, kind of thing. You go, suddenly my life depends entirely on this other creature.
Yeah, being okay, yeah.
And in a way, that's massively reassuring because it gives you a sort of proper sense of purpose and fulfilment rather than just sort of knocking around forever doing projects and sort of going on holidays and indulging. And then, in that really kind of, in a way that I would always have sneered at before, going, oh, you're so special, you've had a child. Oh, God, you've really done the world a favour by reproducing. Yeah. You go, oh, OK, I get it now. Yeah. There is a purpose and there is a sense of continuity in all those stereotypes.
Yeah.
And that has definitely kind of added an extra layer of some sort of emotional understanding to any kind of characters I may be involved in writing.
Yeah.
So it's made me grow up, basically.
Yeah, all that same.
A fucking grown up.
Yeah.
Finally.
It's maybe understanding of vulnerability. I think I sort of, if you sort of see, this is really cheesy, but like, if you see everyone as someone's child, and so then almost if you've had a child, you understand everyone's vulnerability because everyone's been that vulnerable. So therefore, no one's just
like dicks tutting at you on the tube because you've got a buggy or whatever, you know, and you're one of those, which I was for a long time, a really kind of flustered, huffing, too many bags, annoying mother on public transport. And you go, you were a child, you know, that's the classic thing. You were this tiny and useless and needed all this sort of shit and shoveling around, you know, by a put upon mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And it does. And just the very sort of miracle of existence as well.
Yeah,
this all fucking works, you know.
I know.
Your whole body works and you stop being so vain. Well, I stopped being vain or worrying too much about what I fucking look like. You go, this body, no matter what shape, created a human life.
Yeah.
I'm amazing.
Amazing.
And I worked out that's why men hate women, because they can't fucking
do it.
They're so jealous.
They? Yes.
We are powerful.
Yeah, but I had read something recently about, I found that this the most amazing thing when I was pregnant with Zach, actually, funny enough, and I didn't know I was having a boy at that point. And it says something like, and it was really early on, it was like 6 weeks in or something. Yeah. It said, if your baby's a girl, she's growing ovaries right now. And you're like, what?
Wow.
And so, and then I read something recently that said that because you grow all the eggs you'll ever have when you're a baby inside the womb, then you were all in your grandmother's womb.
Like a
Russian doll.
Eggs.
Yeah. And there's something really cool about that, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of continuity. And also women and just like, this is our first. We can worry about the ears and the eyes and the legs later,
let's start with the
ovaries.
As long as you've got your eggs.
Yeah.
But ovaries are incredible. I saw a thing, I can't remember what sort of populist documentary it was, but it was amazing. It was about, especially women who are about to undergo chemotherapy, and young women, they who haven't had children yet, and they take a tiny slice of their ovary, like the tiniest little wafer thin bit of ovary, and they put it on ice, and then after the treatment, and the women's ovaries are sort of often damaged or sort of screwed, but they just pop back in a little slice, and the ovaries regenerate. And they grow just from that slice. I mean, it's phenomenal. And then they can reproduce again. And it's like, it is extraordinary. Like the regenerative power is like a sort of a magic sort of bean.
Stop talking! I'm going to get frustrated.
My grandmother... Well, your grandma, I mean, all our grandparents' generation. You know, my grandmother lived through Nazi occupation and then communism. And,
yes, of course.
You know, like those horrors where you go, the sort of uncontrollable political sort of shit going on around you, on top of worrying, you know, whether your child's got worms or.
Which then puts that in perspective a little bit.
It's just like, you still have to worry about those tiny things whilst, you know, feeling the effects of world events and you know, a bomb falling across the road during the war while you're 9 months pregnant and have a small toddler, and then sort of running down the stairs with shards of glass in your back, and then going, and then probably thinking, oh, I better get their shoes and socks before we leave. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yes, you know, those are tiny things that we panic about, going, oh God, have I packed, you know, her rice cake snacks and some, I'll take some breadsticks because she might be peckish on the train. And I've got a water, must be, because she has to drink mineral water because the water has plastic particles in it. And then,
and your grandmother was like shards of glass in her back.
She was mental. And I don't know if that was before or after the war, but I suspect it might have had an effect.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, I don't know. You can't really live your life going, well, in other places, people are, you know, like when you tell kids, you don't know how lucky you are.
No, you can't. And there are loads of people worse off. It's like, well, like, this is my reality and it's hard. And yeah, no, totally.
It doesn't lift the anxiety about the tiny thing.
No, it's quite good sometimes to root yourself, though, and go, would she have worried about, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was worried yesterday, really worried, pathetically, about the fact that my son just won't go on a scooter, isn't interested. It feels like there's a sea of toddlers all just like blithely kind
what
of like
loser
going on. Yeah, so I'm just like, what's wrong? I don't say this, obviously, but I'm thinking, what's wrong with you? Why can't you go on a scooter like every other child? And I was just, I just got myself really wound up about it.
Yeah.
It's pathetic.
Oh, no, I do that all the time. I'm always judging poor old Maud for her sort of stages of development.
Yeah.
She didn't walk till she was two.
Yeah, no, Zach was almost
old slug legs. So she's the same. She's only just worked out that she can go on a scooter.
Yeah.
And she still has to stop when there's the tiniest little sort of step in the pavement, like a little bit of tiny ledge, maybe 2 millimetres sticking up. She'll stop and lift her scooter over it and then continue. I go, well, she's just naturally quite cautious, which has made me quite cavalier as a parent.
Right, yeah.
Also because Tom is hyper cautious.
Right.
I just go, whatever, you know, smash yourself around. I think that's the only way you learn. But she doesn't. So maybe that's why I can be like that.
Yeah, maybe all their
some
I'm
kids
quite
just, like
that.
Lob themselves up and down things and they're kind of, you know, climbing and scaling, and she's never been like that.
But I sort of think that is quite a good way to be, just sort of not being that worried about. But then I wonder,
But I've made up for it with other anxieties.
Right.
About really uncontrollable things, when she was a baby and I couldn't breastfeed. And you've talked about this as well, where you go, I just felt like I was feeding her dust. And I was essentially feeding her dust and water.
Yeah.
And it was such a horrific feeling. Yeah. And then my paranoia about, you know, sort of chemicals and particles and toxins and artificial substances and kind of trying to keep her this sort of pure, you know, while living in fucking London.
Yes, I know.
Drinking
it's insane, isn't
shit
it?
Water, you know. And but that sort of that level of anxiety, which I think is, you know, a privilege. You know, it's only possible in a very privileged sort of existence. But that hasn't gone away. So while I let her sort of smash around, you know, on a scooter, I won't let her drink tap water.
No.
I've really worked it out. I fucking nailed it.
Do you know
this.
What? I'm definitely like that. And I think there's probably, I say that it's kind of like, oh, it's good for them because it, you know, makes them... It makes, and I do think that's true. Like, they know how to climb stairs. You know, some people go, oh, are they all right on the stairs? It's like, she's two. Of course she knows how to.
And if they fall, they don't fall.
If they fall, they don't
quite
do
small
it again.
And squishy.
Yeah, exactly.
And they
and
don't really.
So I don't get bothered. And I can find it a bit irritating when you're with, especially, you know, I just sort of, two toddlers, right, and they're feral and they're kind of, you know, doing things. And people are like, oh, are they all right on, you know, standing on that, you know, stool that's kind of a foot
next
off the
to
ground.
A precipice,
and you're just like, well, no, not even that, but just not even a big thing. And I'm like, yeah, they're totally fine. So, like, God, that's not something I'd worry about. But then you think, oh, I wonder whether I don't worry about it because I'm just selfish.
Maybe because you've got two now. So you go, if something terrible happens to one, you've always got another backup.
I've got a backup. Yeah, exactly.
See, I don't have a backup. Yeah, I don't have a spare. So I've got to be really careful.
You've got to be really careful with this one.
I should be more careful.
You should be.
I'm going to buy her a helmet now. A helmet for when she just walks to nursery. Do you think that's true though? I always think that. I think obviously if anything ever happened to her, if she ceased to exist in some way, I think I'd have to just top myself. I can't imagine
that's
living on because I don't have another one. But I think if you have another one, you go, well, I have to stay around
for
this
one.
Well, I think
that's the bleak thing because this is such a
sorry, this is really horrible.
No, but
I have thought about this a lot.
I think people do. I think about it all the time, but I think in a way that's bleaker.
What, when you have to stay for the other
one. To lose one and having to stay for the other one.
When,
But it's all, that's an awful thing to talk about, because people do lose children and they...
And they carry on.
Yeah, and they carry on.
But I don't know how. Like, if you've got one, if you've only got one and you lose that child, I don't know. I just, yeah. Although I do know someone who... It was a friend of my grandmother's, actually, and she died. I mean, she was an adult and sort of maybe in her 50s, but she died. And her parents, because she was the only child, her parents both died within 6 months of grief.
Yeah,
I was like, how can that be? I remember hearing the story thinking, oh, it's another one of my grandmother's bullshit, you know, stories.
Yeah.
But actually, no, it's genuine, it's a proven thing. You just sort of wither away and you have no... But I get that.
Because also think that psychology is so important to your well-being that if you've given up mentally...
You have no desire
to
exist anymore.
And also in a basic way that you'd stop looking after yourself. You know, so like basic things that kind of keep... That you do, really simple things that you do to sort of keep yourself alive every day or to keep healthy or whatever.
Because I think it's a weird... It's like an extension of this is your responsibility, your care.
Yeah.
Your care, your role now is to keep this... creature alive and happy.
Yeah.
And even when they're grown up and they've gone, it's still your responsibility.
Yes, yeah.
And so if anything happens, that's it. You're to blame.
Yeah.
It's all about guilt and blame and shame.
And also
that's
having
the sort of
had
essence,
you know,
of motherhood.
If you'd never had a child, then you'd be good and be doing going out for dinners and having a nice life and going on holiday, all that kind of thing.
Enjoying
that. And then that would be fine. But having had that feeling of continuity, as you were saying, you know, that kind of feeling of legacy, that's a horrible word. But,
purpose.
Yeah, purpose and future and that beyond yourself, to then lose that, to then
You realise how bleak and empty your life.
Yeah, yeah. Which it wouldn't have been if you hadn't.
It wouldn't, no.
Yeah.
But that's what was so interesting. You go, and you can't put that back.
No, you can't then have that feeling again.
You can't reverse that.
No, no.
And so my curiosity when I was 40 going, I really just want to know. You know, I wanted to try it out. But you can't just fucking try it out.
No,
that's
no.
it.
Yeah, you can't go, oh my God, this is,
Oh, this is a bit much. Can I give it back? I mean, obviously some people do.
Yeah, no,
sure.
No.
But yeah, there's.
But that was I read. There was a really great interview with Rob Delaney recently about losing his son, and he just wrote so brilliant, or would talk so brilliantly about it. Because obviously, you do have these thoughts. I have these thoughts all the time, but then you feel guilty when you read something like that because you sort of think
this is real.
Gosh, for me, that's just the ultimate horror, and. And for him, it's real. But yeah, he was sort of saying, he was talking of obviously the horror of it, sort of saying how people, you know, can't deal with it and can't deal with talking about it. And all he wants to do is talk about his son.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, sorry, is it difficult for you to talk about that
awkward.
For 2 minutes and then forget about it 2 minutes later? I live with it all the time, you know. And so I'm sure, you know. And also, he was saying, you know, and I am capable of doing other things, like I am capable of laughing and, you know what I mean? Because it's
writing
all,
a hit comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And writing a really successful comedy. Yeah, he did it, didn't he, in the third series?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about I think it's a sort of a female characteristic. You know, I might as well generalise because I'm not a scientist. No one's going to pick me up on it.
It's not Newsnight. You can generalise.
Yeah, fuck it. I say what I want and I will.
Yeah.
But the sort of, I think, visualising catastrophes, visualising horrors is a way of prepping, essentially.
Yeah,
so it's like it is like a prepper mentality that I think women have and you have to have because you do then, you are anticipating dangers every day and horrors and thinking of the worst. So it's like you've got a plan, a kind of unconscious plan.
Yeah.
Maybe an emotional plan, if you like, where you go, I have considered all this.
Yeah.
So if, when, whatever happens, I kind of think, have thought it through and it won't shock me and startle me as much as it would say, well, I know Tom would probably, he reacts because he hasn't thought about these things necessarily because he's got better things to think about than constantly. Fucking roiling in anxiety about what if and maybe. He's much more sensible and straightforward in that way.
We've talked a lot about this before, the link between sort of birth and death as well, because I think I can't separate the two in a way. Like my love for my kids is like knitted together with a fear of something bad happening.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the overwork. That's the burden of responsibility.
Yeah.
Burden slash bonus, because you go, that is, you have to think and you have to feel all those things to basically to qualify as a good parent. You have to feel that weight, I think.
Yeah.
That's what makes you a good parent, is that you give a shit, you know. And I think in cases of sort of neglect of any level, any demographic level, you know, be it middle class sort of absence of emotion, whatever, an actual physical neglect, you go, that's what's missing, is that they don't give a shit. They don't give enough of a shit for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So I think as long as you give a shit, even if you're giving it in
in your own weird,
aggressive, overbearing way, you go, that's, you know, you care. That's all you're supposed to do, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, without necessarily hopefully damaging your child emotionally by making their life a nightmare. But I don't know if you've had Sarah Kendall on, but
she's got some brilliant
stories about her mother, because her mother has this kind of quite eerie sixth sense. Basically, she anticipates danger to such an extent that she's almost psychic. Oh, but I think it's just because she's everywhere she goes, she's looking out for something that could go wrong.
Right.
So anyway, she should tell you the story. But they were driving, her and her dad, like her mum and dad were driving somewhere, and she went, "Stop, Phil, there's a car coming." And like they hadn't even got to the end of the road, and they sort of got to this T-junction, and then this car sped past. Anyway, I can't tell the story properly, but it's like she had had a vision.
Oh my God.
But I think she must just constantly be on alert.
Yeah, so it's like
she's an excellent mother.
It's got to be right.
So she's kind of, I think, because she is an excellent mother, and from all the stories that Sarah's told me, you know, that's just been her life, though, is on constant high alert. Something terrible that could happen. Which is exhausting, but really useful sometimes, I think.
Yes, totally is. I wish I was a bit more like that. I have a lot of the fear, but I don't have. I'm also mostly like, nah, it'll be fine.
Yeah, but that's good. That's a good way of staying sane and
yes, probably
managing your anxiety.
That was interesting. But why don't we talk about something else now?
How did you find work after you'd had Maud? Was it easier or harder or...
Well, I don't know. I feel quite smug about it because I think I found it really easy to go back. In fact, I relished the chance to get away because I didn't enjoy baby care at all. Like before she sort of started really interacting, I didn't know what to do. I still don't know what to do with babies. I find it really... Mm-hmm. I think now probably I'd be a bit more confident and I could sort of own it a bit more. But I'd never had any contact with any babies or children particularly in my life, and just this kind of blob waiting for me to entertain it. And you know, especially the early days when you just don't know what the fuck they want.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I realise now it's probably quite straightforward, really. You just give them, like, food and jiggle them around or something, you know.
Well, it's probably more straightforward than having a toddler in a weird way.
Yeah, so it felt like it was getting harder and harder. And
yeah.
I had less and less of an idea of what to do. And obviously because they go through so many phases of development. Yeah. And you go, as soon as you think you've nailed it, they've shifted onto another like weird set of mental development where they're just, you know, whatever, tantrums, all that sort of thing. I think she's sort of turned a corner now where you go at this age where they suddenly, like, reason starts to kick in and you go, oh, you can reason, and then they're calmer because they understand more. And anyway, but that early stage, I was just, I couldn't deal with it. I was just constantly frustrated and annoyed. And so actually going back to work or popping out for meetings
was
such a relief.
Yeah.
And then weirdly it coincided with getting more and more work, because I think I was much more, I was finally able to make the most of my time, because I'd spent, I don't know about you, but I spent my sort of 20s and 30s idling around, you know, maybe rolling out of bed at 10. Or maybe I'd have a job and I'd have to get up at 6 in the morning and get picked up in a car. Oh, God. And I'd have to go on set and have some makeup put on my face. It was so tiring. And I'd have to learn some lines. Anyway, luckily my acting career fizzled out just before I had Maud. So there was none of that going on. But suddenly the focus, you've got an hour. You've got an hour to do something and you do it. and you do it. And it was like the first time in my life I've actually been able to manage time efficiently. So that actually, I think, contributed. And also, you know, life slipping away and going, oh, fuck, I've got to get on. Because there's nothing like a child to sort of see the clock ticking. And you go, wow, this is all passing me by. I better sort it out. So actually, having her, and also more confident generally about life and myself as a human being, and going, I had a child. Yeah. I'm amazing. Yeah. And sort of the smugness that comes with that. It was never an option for me, never to work. No. I just, from day one, I don't know where that came from, because my mother was entirely work shy and idle.
Right.
Maybe that's why I've always been keen on work. And my grandmother didn't work, like, purposely, because she wanted to prove, you know, because she was very sort of bourgeois and it was beneath her. And in communist era, Czechoslovakia were expected to work no matter what sex, you know, even though as women they'd all still come home and do all the cooking and childcare, sure. But she refused adamantly and somehow got around the system and never worked. So I was like, this is weird. This is wrong. I want to work. Or it just never occurred to me that I wouldn't.
No.
Or that having a child would take some sort of... Also, what we do, we're relatively lucky in that we're flexible, but also not that lucky. You go, if you drop out, it feels like if you drop out for a month, 2 months, that's it. You're forgotten and you lose momentum. So that's
I think that's what we're meant to think.
But
I don't think that's actually I don't think that's the case. I think we have that feeling. I think that's not even just our industry. I think that's a being self-employed.
Right.
That
you just think, you can't say no to anything.
You can't say no to anything because what's around the corner, I don't know if anything will be around the corner, so I have to kind of you know, and there's that kind of like slightly kind of not anxiety, but that kind of like the adrenaline of kind of like keeping that going it means that taking any time out for having a child is tricky. But then, as you say, it just means you've got so much more flexibility because you can choose what you're doing and when you're doing it and all that kind of thing. So actually, there are pros and cons.
That's what I just don't understand, and this is very damning, and obviously I'll eat my words when I'm at the school gates with all these lovely mums.
Yeah.
What are they doing all day?
I know.
These educated women degrees, and I mean, it's like, why?
I tell you what they're doing.
What are they doing?
They are doing, you know, when you see, like, I need, I don't know, a sofa. And I spend a day looking at sofas and I get a sofa at the end of the day, even if it's not the kind of one I thought I wanted. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that'll do.
Practical, efficient.
Yeah. Whereas
get on.
I imagine with them, that's not how they would spend a lot of time finding
shopping
the
around,
thing for the right,
swatches.
You know, neutral toned.
And then it's all beige anyway, isn't it?
It's all beige and stone. Stone?
Stone.
And
fuck off,
you know,
stone.
And it's all... Yeah, so they're doing that. And they're also, these people, it's nails, they do nails.
I'm being really judgmental. I know it's terrible. That's why I say I'll regret it when I meet these women at the school gates and actually they're all very lovely and conflicted.
Like,
and probably like thinking, I wish I were at work, but I don't know how to get back into it. You know,
exactly,
so you go, actually, there's always narratives. But just generally, the ones I'm thinking of are the ones that I've not even thought about it. I just don't understand.
But they turn up at nursery, these women, in, you know, the classic in sports gear, because they're going to drop the child off and then
Lycra
go
moms.
And and then go to the gym. And it's like, well, if I and they'll have cleaners and
they've
all
got
that kind of thing,
a team of
a fleet of staff. So this is how I imagine the day goes. Although the breakfast, they don't have to give their kids breakfast, and that's a nightmare in my house, except their children probably were better off.
It's judgmental, I know, but then you go, but you have a brain and you have an education. I'm talking about a certain demographic, obviously, I'm not talking about all mothers.
Mm.
And then, obviously there are other mothers who have to work, they have no choice, they have to. But I think it is liberating, as someone once said, Arbeit macht frei.
Yeah.
It keeps you sane, it keeps you focused, and it makes you appreciate the time you then have with your child.
Yeah, totally.
I just cannot imagine another way. So I would have probably, you know, done her in or myself in by now if I had to do it full time. So, yeah.
I think, yeah, I also wonder whether, because I do spend quite a lot of time at home, and I wonder whether, and then I get obsessed. Like, I'll suddenly, there'll be a cupboard which I want to clear. And I remember my mum used to do this. And I'll get really angry with David and I'll say, I've told you, like maybe 3 months before I'd said something and then forgotten about it. I told you I want it clear now. You know what I mean? I'll go mental.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have to think, no, I only care about that because I haven't left the house.
Like, yes,
I don't really care about it. And if I was working every day, I probably wouldn't even be aware.
No, so it's true. Like,
so it's that thing where you kind of care, I guess you care about
perspective.
And you care about the shells and the tone of your, the drape that goes over your sofa because...
Well, your perspective shrinks because you're there every day. And yeah, since being busier and busier, I am far less... uptight and hung up about these tiny domestic things. I'm sure Tom will tell you otherwise, but I like to think
we'll have him on next
I'm
week.
Really chillaxed about the whole thing. Stuff that would drive me mad, like really pathetic domestic stuff, I've sort of just kind of don't even notice really anymore. But I think that's because there's too much going on, and then that's a good thing. And I think being occupied and busy is the solution to all sort of mental health issues in a way. Because actually, you go, if you're distracted enough, you don't have time to dwell. Well, my particular, you know, like the sort of anxieties, those sort of the modern malaise of over examining and over panicking about things that are just actually fine.
Yeah, as long as you just a family friend who once said, I don't know if I've said this before, I probably have, God, this is the thing, you end up I repeat myself anyway, so talking about...
Are you drunk?
I just short-circuited. I remember talking to a family friend who was 90, and she very delicately sort of said to me, when I had Zach as a baby and I was talking about whatever shit I was deciding was the best thing or whatever, and she said, do you think your generation has, she goes, my generation, I don't think my generation had enough information when we were having our children, do you think perhaps your generation has too much? And I was like, yeah.
Google.
Yeah. You know, and you think, and that provides the anxiety. You know, they say all the people who read the baby books are the people who have the most anxiety about.
But, you know, as I said earlier, I did read all the baby books, and my thing is always to try and be super prepared and know everything and own it and try and control my tiny world by trying to know everything about, you know, like what was going to happen in the birth, all the horror stories. I wanted to know all that. And I know some people just go absolutely the other way and don't want to know anything.
Yeah.
But I found it reassuring, and that was my way of you know, as I said to when Maud was tiny, it was like Googling all the horrors and going, she's definitely got that and that and that. And yes, she's horrific and this.
Yeah.
But also Googling, thank God for the internet, where you go, is it normal to really despise my 2-year-old? And then you've got a whole sort of slew of other mothers going, I hate my child too, but it's okay. Yeah. And it's like, well, as long as you're saying it and putting it out there.
Yeah.
And it's not secret private shame.
No,
and it's a perfect balance, because you go, it's anonymous, and yet you are expressing something that is taboo.
Yeah.
But safely in the context of the internet. I never thought I'd say that.
Yeah.
In the safe, anonymous context. I never went on Mumsnet, but someone was advocating Mumsnet and going, it's brilliant, because I found all those weird abbreviations and things quite alienating.
Yes.
I didn't quite understand the code, and how do all these people know the code in, and anyway, but that was, but just the internet has been a complete lifesaver in terms of reassurance, and you know, as long as you know what to look for and then interpret it rationally.
Yes, exactly. And go, has he really got all these symptoms?
I never went to the doctor with these things, I'd like to point out. I'm not one of those. Yeah. But maybe it's just sort of being relatively lucky with Maud's health, I suppose. You know, that's sort of not, you know. Anyway, so I think thank God for the internet.
Yeah.
Otherwise I'd have been in a sort of bubble of ignorance and panic.
Yes. And you would be scuttling. Yeah, it's just quite good to have that information, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Well, for me it is. I know some people just really do balk at knowing every gory detail of every possible horror outcome. But I think, you know, that's just what helps me prepare and cope.
I found it quite overwhelming before having a baby, the information, and I didn't want to know anything before. And I still feel I don't really read stuff. I don't read it prior. I read it when something's happening, then I'll Google. You know, my son is being a real little git at the moment.
Is he?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, free.
He's a real little, yeah, and he's a
They go terrible twos, it's brute. Bullshit. It's like terrible twos, threes, and then slightly into fours. And maybe then again when they're teenagers. Yeah, I think, no, I remember it was at this age, Maud was really impossible, I thought, and just, and then you look back and go, gosh, it's only a tiny child.
Yeah.
Why are you so
deal with it?
Yeah, you're an adult, for God's sake. You're all powerful. They do whatever you say.
But and yet you're not, you feel. Because you care. I realise that I lose it when they cry. Like, it upsets me when they're upset. And I don't realise I'm upset and I think I'm angry.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're. Not when they cry because of a good reason, you know, but they cry because they can't, you know, I won't let them run in front of a car.
Yeah.
You know, and that. And it makes me angry because I think, God, it's ridiculous and unreasonable. And, you know, and then I think, no, I'm upset because they're crying. You know,
you're crippled by care, I think. That's what it is. Exactly. You go, you're not just in charge of. That's why I sort of looked at the women working in the nursery and I thought, God, how do you do this day and day? And I thought, actually, because they're not their children.
They're not burdened by that. Yeah,
so they go, exactly. These are kids that are easy to
manage.
And they
can be rational about it.
And they just go, these are the rules, this is how it works, and it's fine. Whereas you go, might be, you know, I don't want to scar my daughter. I really want to smack you, but I'm not going to.
And also,
I want to tell you what to do, but at the same time, I don't want to put it. Yeah. I don't want to alienate you. I want you to like me. It's like it's just sort of an impossible situation to manage.
Yeah.
While they're being difficult,
and they're going to be the most difficult with you anyway.
Yeah,
they're not going to be that.
Yeah, they show you their worst side.
Exactly. So it's like, yeah, oh, God. What's the worst bit of advice or the worst thing anyone said to you when you were pregnant or when you had a small baby?
Well, when I was pregnant, I was slightly deluded that I could have a natural birth at home with a pool, which is obviously a great option for those who can. Mm. I also looked into hypnobirthing.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it was hilarious. I don't really still to this day know how that shit works. Some women just claim it does. But anyway, what I had was a CD of this woman going, "You will give birth gently and easily. Gently and easily. Visualise your baby in a bed of rose petals." I was trying to take it seriously. And I was like really listening to the preparing and rubbing my perineum and all the stuff. You know, I was very, very dedicated to all that. And then obviously the reality of labour and basically crouched in only one position that I could possibly bear and screaming, you know, that extraordinary animal scream. Yeah. And while Tom had to press his thumbs in one spot on my spine because that was the only relief.
Yeah.
And then in the background, this woman going gently and easily. And we go, fucking hell, it is! Take me to hospital! Make it stop! And then going in, having an epidural and a cesarean. I was like, who the fuck did I think I was? I obviously thought I was some kind of earth mother, you know. Never in my life had I ever thought about having children or anything like that. But I obviously just thought, oh yeah, I'm going to fucking, this is going to be a breeze, right? It's going to be a breeze, for fuck's sake.
Until you
look at me, I've got I'm a big boned woman. I've got big hips. I mean, you know, they're sort of, you know, I've got big feet as well, which is apparently an indicator of you know, a big vagina or something. But yeah, I just made that assumption, and it wasn't any one specific person's advice, but it was that I did have a team of midwives. I was very lucky. If you say you're going to have a home birth, you get where I live, you get a team of midwives dedicated, which was brilliant.
I wonder if it was the same
team. Lanes
they were called. Ours with the Valley team,
but they were amazing.
Because then you see the same one every time, so you get to know them.
That continuity, and then I mean, they're all about natural childbirth, which is great, and they're all about the hypnobirth, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But so I really bought into it, and I, which is good, I think, because it meant I was quite positive before until it fucking started, and I was like, what?
Yeah.
I don't like pain. Why did I think I was good with pain?
Yeah.
What led me to think that? Anyway, and then, but very luckily I had this, the same midwife throughout, even the cesarean, she was there for everything.
Oh,
then.
Wow.
It was incredible, yeah. And I thought everyone was lovely at the hospital, basically because I walked in and because I'd always gone, I hate hospitals, I have a phobia of hospitals.
Yeah.
And I walked in and I went, oh, they're all here to look after me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just loved it. I mean, I just sort of handed myself over. Very lovely doctor, a surgeon, Irish, young Irishman. I went, make sure I don't die, please. Don't let me die on the table. And then everything was really fun. I had a really good time. Up until after Maud had come out, and then I sort of passed out because I'd lost loads of blood.
Oh my God.
But that was all right. I was just like, hey, this is great. Everyone's here for me.
It's
all about me.
So did you ask, so you were going down the natural birth route,
yes,
and then you went, I can't do this, this is awful.
But there was
was there something that happened that meant that you...
No, there was the point when Tom was trying to inflate the birthing pool and it kept deflating because it had a slow puncture. That should have been a sort of a moment when I should have realised that this wasn't going to happen.
Was there anyone else there at that point?
What, midwives in the...
Yeah.
No, this was early on. I mean, it's like, it's that weird thing. Even now you go, why did it take... It took like 3 or 4 days, from the first to the end. You go, so it's such a weird long process.
Also, because I had gas and air for both of them.
Yeah.
So it's like, I did actually have chemicals to make it easier, but I didn't, it wasn't, yeah. So it was, but I had the second one at home, but my labours were like,
2 seconds?
5 hours.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
And that's from
the
very first twinge to her coming out.
That's incredible,
So actually, you probably could have withstood. Do you know what I mean? Because by the time you even know you're in labour...
I don't like this.
It's kind of too
late. Over.
And it's over.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas like 3 days, there's no way I would have...
It just wears you down.
...stuck around for 3 days and I would have gone to hospital. So people kind of make an assumption that you're a kind of person if you've done one thing or another. It's like luck of the draw. Like it literally is just like, there's no way on earth I could have dealt with that one day, three.
I just did make an assumption that I had a really high pain threshold, which don't.
But maybe you do. But maybe you do. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
like, maybe
you'll never know. And, how do you measure that shit? You don't.
You know, with the differing lengths in labour, surely there's a different intensity of pain.
Yeah, yeah. It starts. You realise it starts quite gently because you think, oh God, this is terrible, and then it gets worse.
Yeah,
and you go, where's this going?
Yeah.
But
my intense pain probably lasted in total an hour, and that was coupled with a feeling of, you mentioned having a poo earlier, but like that feeling of, I could feel the baby moving and coming out, so I knew that there was going to be
motion.
Yeah, and that there was going to be a release, that there was going to be a...
You felt a result coming.
Yeah, I could feel it coming all the way through.
I never got past 3 centimetres, so
there you go.
There was no fucking hope. Yeah. And every time they measured, they went, no, still, and you just go, oh, come on. Yeah, no, it was funny. But what was funny was which I didn't realise, is that you get those big gaps of no pain in between when you're actually quite...
I didn't have
you
that.
You go, oh, no, having a chat, and then go... Aah! And then I carried on, got in the cab, go to the hospital, and then we're in the waiting room, and there was like... It was the middle of the night, there was one man there and I sort of felt one coming. I sort of turned to the man and went, I'm terribly sorry, I'm going to make a very loud noise. And then just fucking scream.
Yeah.
Do you know what? That screaming, I wish I could do it again. I think it's like primal scream therapy, which I would really like to try.
Yeah.
I've never felt so released emotionally.
Yeah.
I think I was actually quite liberated afterwards, sort of physically and sexually, in a way that I've since then kind of obviously clammed up again.
Well, you feel like a real animal, don't you? It's so, and it's so
and
weird.
The noise that comes from, it really does come from somewhere very profound.
Yeah.
It's a proper release.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I got to do a bit of shouting before I then went, drugs.
Exactly. What was I thinking?
I'm glad I had a go at feeling that feeling of release.
Yeah, we had, that was the other thing with the 5-hour labour. It means you don't really have any downtime.
You don't have, really? So there was no.
So there was no. It was more like a gradual thing. So it kind of got but like, I think both times I probably had like, I can't remember how many minutes in between contractions, but like, 5 So like, so it was kind of like, and I remember people saying, in your hospital bag, pack some, an iPad with all your favourite things on it. And I just remember after Zach thinking,
when would you ever have that? Oh no, I had hours. Like... I had snoozes.
Did you?
I was asleep in between having things. And then when we were in hospital, I was like, or by them, because the epidural thing's amazing. You can feel these wibbly wobbly contractions going on, yeah. but you can't feel them. Yeah. It's so brilliant. So I had a little snooze while Tom was sort of glued wow. to the monitor, because I was then all sort of strapped up, monitored. They were going, yeah. I'm worried about the baby. Oh, that's it, because as soon as I got in and had an epidural and sort of lay down, basically, I kind of, my afterbirth, no, what's it called?
Placenta.
No, sorry, the bit before. My waters broke.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
My waters broke and a load of shit came out.
Oh, yeah.
So Maud had chat herself in the room.
Oh, and that's quite bad, isn't
And then
it?
They were like, oh, we're glad you're here. So I was then, I felt right. validated that yeah, I hadn't yeah, just whipped yeah. out and yeah, gone, yeah, yeah, I yeah. can't do it.
Yeah, because you would have had to have gone in anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I just...
Yeah, yeah,
Well,
yeah.
that's what the midwife said anyway. It's yeah. okay, you would have had to come in anyway. And I was like, oh, are you assuming that I'm feeling like, you know, like I've wimped out by not staying at home?
Because I'm not. I'm perfectly comfortable yeah, with
judgy.
My decision. Yeah,
Mrs. Judgy. Anyway, yeah, the horrors... But it's, yeah, I had a very good experience, I think, and I was really impressed with everyone at King's. And I had, from day one, I think I was very lucky, you know, especially yeah. compared to some people who I've spoken to, the same postcode, yeah, whatever, had yeah. a terrible shocker.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is all utterly individual.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, you know, always the assumptions you make, and the massive assumption I made, which was that I would find it a breeze, and yeah, I don't know yeah. where I got that from.
That's funny.
But much
better to have that assumption.
Yeah, I think so, rather than just, the anxiety. Yeah, yeah.
Whatever will happen, won't it? So you can't control it, so you might as well feel positive about it beforehand, mightn't you? Just like,
deluded.
You can be dreading it and it's fine, much better the other way around.
Sort of strutting around going, yeah. hey, I've nailed this.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
And what advice would you give? So if there was someone here sitting here, pregnant,
a mum to be,
about to have a child, what would you say?
Well, the main thing, although I was listening to one of your previous guests, and I think they've changed their policy on breastfeeding, because that was another thing that really damaged me mentally afterwards, was not being able to breastfeed
yeah.
and never having been told that that might happen.
Yes,
and it was only ever an option yeah. to either breastfeed or not, and it was yes. a choice, and that's yes. how, and no one, and maybe this is me not having done enough research as well, I again assumed that I would just do it because
yes,
I wanted
same.
To.
Yeah.
Absolutely couldn't, and then felt terrible about it.
Mm-hmm.
Combined with all the hormones that come with the whole breastfeeding thing anyway, I would just say, if possible, kind of prepare yourself to be really in a mess. Like, prepare for the mess.
Yeah.
And try and kind of just clear away everything else.
Yeah.
Even don't let any... Like, people want to come round and stuff. Obviously, that's, you know, quite familiar. Yeah. Just don't let anyone in.
Yeah.
You, your partner, anyone else you trust, yeah. if you have a midwife, whatever.
Yeah.
Just don't...
Yeah.
Don't let anything else in.
No, yeah.
Like, clear it all away. But then ongoing, it all creeps up anyway, because life does. And then, if you go crazy, go to the doctor and get some medication.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that's what I did. But it took me about a year to get to that stage.
Yeah.
Because even though I'd taken things before I got pregnant, I then stopped so I could get pregnant and not be on anything. And my friends who saw me in that state that I got into a year in, just went, why aren't you back on the drugs? You know, you're not breastfeeding.
Yeah,
what's the deal?
Yeah,
and I was
yeah.
like, and I'd forgotten. Because when you do, when you get kind of a slippery slope and you descend and you sort of don't even notice.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't notice it's happening and you forget what you used to do to cope before. Because you can't do those things. I would take myself off and, you know, into a darkened room and just disappear. But you can't because you've got a baby.
And was it worse if you felt sort of anxiety and things before? Was it worse after having it? Wasn't a recognisable, it wasn't like you're going, oh, I'm going down this path again? Or
no, it was worse because you're so focused on the baby and you're so focused on looking after them, you forget. And it's so ridiculous, isn't it? And you go, how could you forget that this is something that this is how you would react to a stressful situation, because how you've always reacted.
Yeah.
And yet you sort of blame yourself and you go, it's my fault, I don't know what to do and I don't know how to cope and I'm to blame. And it's because you are solely responsible, really, essentially, as a mother. I mean, obviously, once they're out, it should be a shared responsibility, but you still feel that kind of...
Yes, there is a primal thing as well.
It's up to me. And then, so that pressure, and you don't recognise what's going on, you don't recognise that you're sliding.
Yeah.
Even if people are around you, and it's that thing you go... Also, sometimes people don't know what to say or how to deal with it. And, like, Tom's worked it out now. He knows what to do with me.
Yeah.
But... at the time, I think he doesn't know, you don't know, is it because of the baby? Is it this? Is it that? Yeah, like, yeah. Maybe it will pass. Yeah. Is it just a phase? Yeah, everyone's a bit up and down. Of course they are with hormones.
Yeah. So,
I think my advice would be, or certainly to say to your partner, if you have a good enough relationship, that they can look out for you and go, as soon as you're feeling wobbly, go straight to the doctor.
Yeah.
Because actually they're very sympathetic. They're really looking out for postnatal symptoms, because they do, they're on it, they've been briefed, they've got the drugs ready,
they're just waiting
to write that prescription.
Honestly,
there's absolutely no shame, and no, I can only recommend antidepressants, because they just take the edge off, even if it's for a year or I don't know 6 months. Just,
I have a really good friend who did exactly that, and again, very similar to you, she'd been on medication before and then had sort of got herself in sort of quite a frenzy after her second, not even after her first.
Right. Yeah.
And again, like you, took her ages to realise, oh no, hang on.
Yeah.
I think I need to.
There's also a certain euphoria that comes with being pregnant. If you're lucky enough to have a straightforward pregnancy, you go, actually, you do feel pretty full of beans, because that's, you're sort of meant to, you're hormonally geared.
There is that, as you go, wow,
especially that phase, you know, when you suddenly have lots of energy and you go, hey, I'm a fucking superhuman.
Yeah.
I remember strutting around feeling really smug and really like, look at me, I've got a baby in me.
Yeah.
Apart from when I woke up once, the day of my 20-week scan, and thought she'd disappeared. Thought I'd imagined the whole thing.
Oh my god!
And I went to the bathroom and I was like that, just rubbing my stomach, going, "Where is she? Where is she? There's nothing there. There's nothing there. There's nothing there."
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite weird. And someone said, "Oh, it's because if you have a long body, like a long torso, then babies sort of fit in. Like, you know, you can have it
right. They can, so you don't see a bump.
It's not so obvious.
Yeah, right.
So she actually disappeared. It's proper weird. Like, oh god, she's not here." And then went to the 20-week scan. She's there.
Sorry,
she was. But they told us it was a girl at the three-month scan. I know. Hang on. What's the first one you had?
Yeah, three months, 12 weeks. Yeah,
the 12-week one. Yeah.
Wow.
We had this brilliant sort of Bulgarian. What's it called? Sonographer.
Sonographer. Yes, that's it.
Anyway, she was great. She went, "I can tell you what it is." And we went, we hadn't even thought about it. We hadn't talked about it. And we looked at each other and went, yes. And she went, "It's a girl." And Tom was obviously very excited because he's already got a son.
Yeah.
So now he has a gentleman's pair. and we were like, "How can you tell? What?" And she said, "You can tell by the tailbone which way it goes." But it's not 100%. Really? So she shouldn't really have said, because then if it had been a boy, we'd have been like, "Oh, God."
And you could have been one of those families who'd. Oh, no, it's usually the other way around.
What, had him adopted out?
Yeah, you would have just.
I'd have given him away.
Yeah.
I don't want a boy.
Oh, what am I going to do with a boy?
I want a dick growing inside me.
Ew.
Gross. Anyway, so yeah. It was, yeah. So there were moments of euphoria and joy. And that's probably why you don't notice the slide as well, because you go, there's enough good times to distract you.
Yeah.
And
before
it hits you properly. But yeah. Lucky, I mean, I was lucky to have very good, supportive friends who are very open and on
and
it,
knowledgeable
with any sort of, you know, health issues, mental or otherwise.
Yeah.
I know a lot of hypochondriacs, so it's really useful.
It's great.
That'd be my advice. Hook up with a hypochondriac. They'll sort you right out.
Thank you so much to Barunka O'Shaughnessy for coming in to talk to me. What a bird. And for talking so honestly about lots of things that people find quite difficult to talk about. Next week, my guest is Stuart Goldsmith, the host of the podcast The Comedian's Comedian. That will be very interesting. He's just had his second baby. We were going to have him on earlier, but it just seemed cruel. So that will be fun. Now, during the episode that you've just heard, you might have heard me a few times about to arrogantly pronounce what I thought certain women we were talking about did during the day, and I never got to it. And I thought I would get to it now and give you some idea of about what I think these women do as part of their daily routine. They wake up, wash their hair, blow dry it, probably put on face masks and toners and cleansers and exfoliators and other things that I literally don't even know exist. By the time they glide downstairs, they look like they're going to a wedding, but in designer gym gear. They find their children playing quietly with wooden Montessori toys. They give their grateful silent children multigrain cereal and tuck into a juicy grapefruit themselves. I hate grapefruit. While their husbands try to mansplain Brexit to them, and they pretend they're listening when they're actually browsing Pinterest for shells they can put in the guest bedroom. Then they kiss their husband goodbye and haul their tiny little snappable bodies into their massive SUV that's parked badly outside their house. They slowly crank it up to neutral and, either knowingly or unknowingly, it's never really clear, enjoy the kindness of strangers as they steamroll past. After they drop the children off at nursery, having handed in the homemade muffins they made for the teacher's birthday, popped a thank you card into one child's locker and blanked a couple of fat mothers that scare them, they go to the gym and work out for 16 hours. They then race home to rearrange the few books they have on their shelves, to colour coordinate the spines, and wait for the children to be dropped off. Then all three of them go out into the street looking for people living nearby and bite their living flesh off, killing them and subsequently reanimating their dead corpses to join their army of the living dead. I could be wrong, but that's how I imagine it is. I thought I would just have a few ideas, and then I just started writing. Something. So I have to say it was quite cathartic. But, you know, I could be wrong. So what do you do on the days off when you're not working? And if you're not working and say your kids are around or they're not around, I want to hear from you. Tell me. Find me on Twitter at trapdoorpodcast or email me at trapdoorpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, as always, and I will see you next week. Bye!
Bye-bye.